Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Is our old friend vitamin D, of which we have very little here in the Pacific Northwest, is it a good way to treat something like diabetes and perhaps COVID? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. First of all, let's remind people why vitamin D is a particular concern in this part of the country.
Frankly, if you test most people in the Pacific Northwest, unless they're taking a vitamin D supplement, they will have low vitamin D levels. And why is that? It's because, you know, a good portion of the year here we're without adequate sunlight. And sun is one of the primary ways that our body actually synthesizes vitamin D. Vitamin D has long been studied for what is its role. It turns out that it's a potent anti-inflammatory. And there's been a host of studies that have looked at the role between having low vitamin D levels and the development of type 1 or type 2 diabetes.
So type 1 diabetes. Now, I always thought that was something that you were basically born with. And yet the studies show that vitamin D could treat that?
Right. So type 1 is really thought to be an autoimmune condition. And that is that your body essentially attacks the cells in your pancreas that produce insulin. There is a genetic predisposition to having it. But in some of the studies, what they've done is they've actually looked at children who had a genetic risk for developing type 1 diabetes, and they divided them into two groups. They provided vitamin D supplementation to half of those who were at risk, and they didn't provide vitamin D supplementation to the other half of those who are at risk. This study was done in Finland, where there's a problem with there being even more darkness than we have in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
In those children who were given vitamin D supplementation, it actually lowered the risk of them developing type 1 diabetes. Now, maybe that it delayed it. We don't know for sure what the long term is. But even if it delayed the onset of type 1 diabetes, that's a good thing, because the harm comes from having ongoing type 1 diabetes with poor regulation of your blood sugar.
What about type 2, which is the one that develops when you become overweight?
Right. So, yeah, type 2 diabetes is often caused by excess visceral fat. In type 2 diabetes, you make insulin, but your cells are resistant to it. They don't respond appropriately to it. The end result in both cases is that you end up with high blood sugar levels, and that the blood sugar is inflammatory. And this is one of the reasons that it's thought that vitamin D, which is anti-inflammatory, may play an important role. But yes, there have been studies that have demonstrated that type 2 can be modulated, or that vitamin D can have an effect on the severity of type 2 diabetes. It may not necessarily prevent it, but it may lower the overall severity of it. And there have been studies that have shown that cells that are exposed to vitamin D are less insulin resistant and more able to take glucose up inside them as an energy source and reduce blood sugar levels.
So are there diseases besides diabetes then that more vitamin D could help with? And of course, I'd have to ask you about COVID.
You know, early on there was some suggestion, and there actually are some studies that suggest that having low vitamin D levels may make you more prone to infection. And this was especially noted in people who were Black, that they had over 2.5 times greater risk of getting an infection, a COVID infection, if they had a low vitamin D level versus a normal vitamin D level. And so, you know, there were proposals that people should take vitamin D supplementation in relatively higher doses. You know, it's been proposed also that, you know, taking vitamin D would lower your risk of cardiovascular disease or lower your risk of cancer. The studies on that have really provided mixed information, and I would say that it's not clear when it comes to those two.
So is this still being actively researched? Is there any more to learn here, or should we just go ahead and all take a vitamin supplement just in case it's correct?
People in the Pacific Northwest really do need to take vitamin D. The NIH suggests that people should maintain a vitamin D level between 50 and 100.
Now, what does that mean? Is that something that you could achieve with a couple glasses of milk a day, or do you have to have a special supplement to get that?
In the Pacific Northwest, you would have to have a supplement to do that, because we just don't have enough sun. So, you know, it's usually recommended that people take 4,000 to 5,000 international units of vitamin D a day to maintain a level in that range. There have been rare case reports of people getting hypervitaminosis. In order to achieve that, though, you would have to take an excessive amount of vitamin D for a prolonged period of time, or basically, you know, literally overdose on vitamin D. So that's not that likely to happen. It's pretty safe to take, you know, 5,000 international units of vitamin D a day, and there's a lot of benefit to doing that. It is a good idea for people to take a daily dose of vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. Or just spend the winter in California.
Yeah.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thanks, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, and we are so happy to welcome Dr. Molly Greaves-Groh. She's a pediatrician at Seattle Children's, and she's coming on at my request because when it comes to COVID and this pandemic, parents are on the struggle bus. And I know that because I am one to an 8-year-old and a 2.5-year-old. And as the nation tries to return to normal, I feel sometimes like parents are being left behind. Like, testing's available. Oh, wait, but the testing that's available, parents can't use to get their kids back into school. So I wanted to ask the doctor just some advice and tips on how to continue to navigate through this as a parent, and also the best way to encourage mask wearing and other activities for children in this pandemic. So, you know, doctor, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think this all stemmed from an instance at my 2.5-year-old's daycare in which they were starting to require masking for kids at 5 years old, which is the last age at this daycare before they move on to public school. But they changed that now to 3-year-olds. And I don't know if it's selfish of me to say so, but I had really hoped that my youngest, who was 9 months when the pandemic really started in the lockdowns, I thought there's no way she's going to have to learn how to normalize a lot of this. Like, she's going to escape this struggle. But now, with the pandemic still in full swing and her about to turn 3, I'm really struggling to get her to wear a mask. Like, she's the most anti-mask person I know. So what is your advice for that and other parents going through this struggle with their kids?
Well, I think it's just really important to acknowledge it is hard. And I agree, it's not an easy process. It is challenging to get kids to be on board at all times with the masking. I think I'll offer a few suggestions and hopefully something will resonate. I think for kids at this age, certainly we want to harness their kind of helper instinct, as I call it, that they do want to be helpful. And when we can help them channel that into appropriate ways, we can get them to be a little bit more, I think, compliant with mask wearing. I think that they really see themselves as becoming older at that age. And so if we kind of show that this is something that older kids do and that they're part of being the responsible older kids that are helping by helping decrease the spread of COVID, that can help them be a little bit more likely to be on board with masks. I think another piece of this is that kids at that age are also wanting more autonomy and choice. Mm-hmm. And so the extent that we can make options available for the types of masks, the color, the characters, the things that help them feel a little bit more interested in the type of mask that they are being asked to wear. And certainly comfort and fit is part of that too. And so finding masks that are the right size and that also appeal to them, I think is helpful. And then I think finally, just being able to really call out and name how frequently we see them doing it right and recognizing them for that and being appreciative over and over for catching them doing it well when they're wearing a mask, and just trying to make sure that we are honestly seeing them as the people that we're asking them to be and that it's hard to do. So we want to thank them for that.
I'm just going to be honest and tell you that sounds like a lot of work this far into the pandemic. I am so tired, Molly. But we will keep trying. On the flip side of that, you know, we have allowed her to walk around reasonably without a mask. And, you know, if she doesn't comply with the masking at her school by the time she's 3, I'm sure they'll give her some grace. But what is the actual risk to her at 2.5 with her mini lungs? No comorbidities. She's a, you know, average child. What is the safety precaution for kids that young when it comes to COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think thankfully we are seeing that Omicron is not any more serious than the other variants. It certainly spreads faster and easier, and that's what's been the most challenging for us with Omicron, is how contagious it is. So thankfully, it is more of an upper respiratory infection for most people than it is a lower respiratory infection that can get into the lungs and cause the serious lung complications and pneumonia that we've seen for a lot of the pandemic with other variants of COVID. I think we still know that some kids, we just can't predict, some kids can get sicker and some adults can get sicker with COVID and with the Omicron variant. And it is hard for us to know who that's gonna be ahead of time. So we all just wanna keep taking some of those really basic precautions. I mean, we can hope for the best that they're gonna have a less problematic version of it, but nobody loves being sick. So I think the extent to which we can take reasonable precautions, I think is important. And I think that's a balance at this point in the pandemic. I hear you. We are all so tired of it. We are exhausted by this process. And being in healthcare and knowing that we are still just slogging through trying to get this pandemic under control and having this Omicron variant that has just taken off and is everywhere, no one is enjoying it. I can acknowledge that.
So, Dr. Groh, what do you look for in terms of symptoms? Because kids are always getting the sniffles. So how do I know whether it's just the sniffles, a reason to test the child, or take her into the doctor?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think we unfortunately can't predict. Some people have almost no symptoms with the Omicron variant and other versions of COVID, and others have a lot more symptoms and feel really ill. I think, you know, honestly, at this point, the best, you know, approach is really to test if there are any symptoms or to keep people home for the, you know, entire time that it's recommended to isolate. I think, thankfully, the isolation is now a shorter recommended period, which helps. But I think, you know, it is helpful to know, you know, especially if they're going to be around other people and it's difficult to isolate potentially. Really, ideally, everybody's getting tested when they have symptoms. That includes the sniffles, a cough, feeling fatigue, headache, even GI symptoms for younger kids can also be a little bit more common to see with viruses like COVID.
I have one granddaughter who, because there's not a lot of socializing going on, has bonded to Paw Patrol on some channel.
And on the double, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
like
rubble
my
on the
June
double. And
watches it too. She's got
well,
all
the here's
stuff
the thing.
Her.
If you can just find a Paw Patrol mask, I bet she'll yeah. wear it. I mean, anything Paw Patrol, our granddaughter will covet. So,
are they wearing masks yet?
Yeah. The old oh, wow. the 2.5-year-old is pretty good at wearing masks, and the 1.5-year-old is she imitates what her parents do, but I haven't seen her wear a mask yet.
Oh. I'm behind the curve then.
Paw Patrol, Colleen. Paw Patrol. Oh,
you'll get there.
Yeah. And I hope this helps other families too. I know that just a lot of parents in my circle feel left behind in this pandemic. Yeah. That people are like, hey, yeah. great, we're getting free tests. And they're like, yeah, but we can't even use those for our kids to get back into daycare and school. Like, what about us?
Right.
So thank you. This has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you and sort of suck that knowledge out of your brain. I hope we can have you back. It's Dr. Molly Greaves-Groh, a pediatrician at Seattle Children's. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Monday morning, it's time for the sentencing report, and today's cases involve a repeat pimp, a killer, and a first-time bust for child pornography. All were sentenced in King County Court last week with the details. Here's Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, first up is that case of a repeat pimp who was sentenced on Friday, and these are very common. You just don't hear about these cases very often.
Winfred Robertson is a guy who police said that he profited from the victimization of young women by trafficking this woman across multiple states and forcing her to work as a prostitute. He advertised her on websites that are known for prostitution. He was convicted of promoting prostitution in the second degree. And also attempting to elude police, because when Kent police tried to stop him, they pulled him over and he hit the gas once he thought he could get away. Kent police did a smart thing and they said, we're not going to chase you because that will endanger others, but we know we're going to find you again. And they did through good police work.
So the guy has a very long history of you know, promoting prostitution is the official charge, but it means pimp.
He has convictions for rape, attempted rape, assault, unlawful gun possession, you know, multiple assault convictions. And even with that, the standard sentencing range set by state lawmakers is 22 to 29 months. His offender score after all of those convictions was a 6, which is still not especially high.
And that is something we had a long discussion about. That's not a very long sentence, especially when it's repeat. His previous histories are rape, attempted rape, assault, unlawful gun possession, and several other assaults. And he has shown that he will do this, victimize girls and put them on the websites over and over and over again. In this particular case, the court documents say he threatened to kill this girl's family and her friends if she ever said anything to anyone about being trafficked, and, you know, just was able to get that kind of control. It's kind of a domestic violence almost situation, and it's still just 26 to 29 months.
Yikes. And at least do you get a heads up before he's released?
No. As the girl, yes. As the person who was trafficked, they do try, I know, to give that just like they would in a domestic violence case, yes. But that doesn't help. I mean, these are the kind of guys that we see and we hear about that are what the human trafficking billboards are for, right? They're right. The guys who linger at the bus station and wait for somebody who's a runaway or something and, you know, take advantage, give them food, that kind of thing. So way too many of them. And, very likely he'll serve his time, he'll get out, and he'll go right back to doing what he was doing before because there's no program for him. There's nothing.
Can't they put a chip in his butt or something like that?
I don't know, but that's certainly worth looking into. I would agree with you on that. This next case is it's a double murder, and it's a little dark.
Raymond Sanchez is a guy. This was a double murder that happened in the 2200 block of First Avenue in Seattle's Belltown neighborhood in January of 2016. This was in the Bell Tower, which folks will know that's been there for 40 plus years. The way this led to the charges and a conviction was there was a DNA match. This was a guy who was in CODIS from previous convictions out of South Carolina. What the defendant said here was that he knew one of the victims from a meth deal on Capitol Hill. There was also an allegation of a sex act involved. There was a fight inside there with a machete. It really brutal details of this crime. And without elaborating, it sounds like something that you would see on television. This guy turned on the faucet to mask the sound of what was happening.
And it really does. And I won't share the details from the court documents with you, but it sounds like a horror movie. It's absolutely terrifying. And all over, you know, some sort of fight over drugs, it sounds like. He was sentenced on Friday.
This went to a jury trial, and he was convicted of both counts of second-degree murder here. The standard range would be 12 to 20 years, 147 to 244 months. But what the judge sentenced him to on Friday was 360 months, to be followed by 36 months of community custody. And there was a deadly weapon enhancement that added several years to it. So he got 30 years for these two murder cases, which I think is more in line with what people expect for a double murder case.
And you don't always get that. A lot of times it's less than that. So that was a good one. The next one I'm not going to give you too many details on. It's the first time engaging, not making, but viewing possession of this child pornography. And I'll let Casey tell you about Michael Wright.
Michael Wright was a guy who was convicted of a felony and a misdemeanor case. The felony was attempted viewing of depictions of minors engaged in sexually explicit conduct. That's a long-winded way of saying attempted viewing of child pornography is the colloquial way of saying it.
So this is we're highlighting because the details of the case are, again, pretty extreme that are not for sharing. But 3 to 9 months is the standard sentence for this because it's a first time offense. Mm-hmm. The depictions are pretty extreme. So we talked a lot about that. And that being the standard, the same judge had given a harsher sentence a year before in a similar case. This guy is ordered to go to the court for the evaluation that they do for recommendations when you're engaged in something like that. Sexual deviancy is what it's called for the first time, to try to make sure that they, you know, they go through the classes and get help with that before they engage in something much, much worse. But that's just it. That's 3 to 9 months.
That's it. But he has to go to classes. Do the classes work?
So that's the thing. Nobody really tracks that, right? Nobody tracks that. And Casey and I were talking, and he said it's kind of like the equivalent of when you have to go to, if you say, yeah, I'll go to traffic school to take care of that with my ticket. It's just a box. It's a thing you have to do. Like anger management class or a DUI class, that kind of thing. But unfortunately nobody knows, nobody tracks it. So
yeah. Well, that's the is there nothing in the law, and this happens with other crimes too, right? Especially somebody who is treated for some kind of mental illness that caused them to commit a heinous crime. What I, as somebody on the outside who wants to be protected from these people, would like to see is some kind of certificate that says the treatment worked. This person has now not only been cured, but has been trained in some kind of job skill so they can earn a living. And, they've got connections. They've got either family support or close friends who are going to monitor them.
Right.
And therefore, it is safe to release this person. But I gather we don't have any process like that.
We don't have anything. We barely have a process to get people, especially when you're talking about mental health, to get them that kind of treatment that they need, let alone that tracking and that follow-up and that full kind of wraparound. That's when you hear wraparound services, to make sure that there's something on the end of it, right? There's discussions about that. There's a lot of appetite for that, but we're so far removed from that right now. It's going to take years to get to that.
Guy Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. CBS's Steve Hartman takes us to Sackett's Harbor, New York, where the same thing happens every time an ambulance arrives at someone's house.
A lot of people just come up and ask you, like, wait, how old are you?
You're the EMT.
Or like, when's the ambulance coming?
So what do you say?
We just explain to them, we are the ambulance.
These baby-faced first responders took over the village's emergency medical services not long after COVID hit, when all the older EMS volunteers either couldn't or wouldn't do the job anymore. That exodus, part of a national trend. In rural America, 35% of ambulance services are all volunteer. And many of those departments, 69%, say they're struggling to find help. Fortunately, at least in Sackett's Harbor, desperation led to inspiration.
In New York State, you can be an EMT at 17 and can assist even younger. And when these local high schoolers heard that, they decided to step up, took the required training, and resuscitated the department.
We went from not even having our licenses to saving people's lives.
Being able to help those people, I really like doing that.
And by all accounts, they are doing that. Whether you've fallen off a ladder,
they're very professional,
have severe chest pains,
they know what they're doing,
or can barely breathe.
Absolutely credit them for saving my life.
This group of teens and young adults save the day almost every day, sacrificing much of their free time and surrendering some of their innocence. They say the hardest part is telling people their loved one is gone.
It's like time freezes and everything stops, and that's one of the hardest things to do, for sure.
And then you go back to algebra class.
Yeah. What's hard?
So why do it?
Because who else is there to do it if we don't? Someone needs to. Someone needs to step up and do it.
That's CBS's Steve Hartman in Sackett's Harbor, New York. Proud of that young man. What an example.
And now it's 7:49, direct from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9. Here is G. Scott with a recap of weekend football.
It was absolutely the greatest divisional playoff games I've ever seen in my life.
That's what I hear.
I've never seen four games back to back to back to back that were incredible.
So how many hours were you in front of the screen?
So let me tell you, let me explain. You know what I mean? On Saturday, it wasn't the plan. I did my thing, went and got my hair cut, got all prettied up, came home because the plan were we were going to go downtown because they had the Joe Coy concert happening downtown. We had a bunch of friends that was going to that, but we were just going to be going to the dinner at the butcher's table, which that's another story in itself. Anyways, so I come home from getting that. And so before me and Lillian was going to, before we left, just so happened the game was on. And so we finished watching the game then, and that was the Bengals. They had beat the Titans, okay? Got done with that. Then once we got downtown, we're there at the hotel and everything, then we watched the San Francisco beat the Packers, and that was a 13-10 game. And oh, by the way, when the Bengals beat the Titans, that was 19-16. You still talking about great football. So that was Saturday. So going into Sunday, I'm thinking, okay, I think that Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I think that they're going to beat the Rams. And I also think that the Buffalo Bills are going to beat the Kansas City Chiefs. Yes, I was wrong about both games, but here's what I was definitely wrong about. I had no idea that I would witness the greatest QB duel of all time. I've never seen two quarterbacks the way that Patrick Mahomes for the Kansas City Chiefs and Josh Allen for the Buffalo Bills. I've never seen that before in my life. We're talking about 32 points scored in like 2.5 minutes if you count overtime and the end of regulation. Wow. It was an absolute shootout. I mean, if I would have missed this, I don't know what I would be able to say. Now, it's one of those things, like if you see the highlights don't even do it justice. You actually had to have sat in there. I posted videos on Twitter of my, we were screaming. Screaming.
I see that.
We were screaming. Go to my Twitter, at G Scott on Twitter. Screaming.
Wow.
That's how amazing these games were.
How much money did you put on those games?
No, player. I don't bet.
No, you do not.
No, sir. No, sir.
It's legal now.
Hey, I don't subscribe to that. I think gambling on sports is a terrible, terrible idea. No, okay. I just, you get to
enjoy
it. You're
saying it was possible to enjoy the game without having money on it, huh?
Absolutely. at least last night's games. But yeah, it was great. And then I wanted to see, and then I saw Warren Moon. I saw what he had to say on Twitter. He said it was the greatest divisional games he's ever seen. So I'd be like, if he says that, then I know I was right. But because I just kind of tweeted it fast. What do you got, Carly?
So who's going to the Super Bowl then?
Well, by the way, I've been wrong the entire time, but I'm going to say the Super Bowl is going to be between the Cincinnati Bengals and the San Francisco 49ers. And by the way, if you saw me on Twitter, yes, I have been rooting for the Niners. Well, first of all, you think I wanted Aaron Rodgers to win? No. I wanted the Niners to win that game. The Niners
But you don't want them to win the Super Bowl.
I don't really care, really. I want the Bengals to win the Super Bowl.
Okay.
But you remember 40 years ago yesterday, the Super Bowl was the Cincinnati Bengals and the 49ers.
So really? we're in the Matrix. This is a system glitch that is happening again.
The pandemic
is going to start over again.
And I think that was like our reward for what we've been going through. I think the football personnel is like, you know what? Let me give you guys some good football. And oh, by the way, I know Sully said something to you guys a little bit earlier when he was talking about the grim. If things are grim, be the grim reaper. That's what Andy Reid said about Patrick Mahomes in that comeback right there. He's like, well, things look grim. Just be the Grim Reaper.
Okay.
But that didn't go over well with Dave, though. I could tell.
I still don't understand it, but I'll look it up, and then I'll drop it at a party and see if everybody says how cool I am.
Dave, you go to parties?
No. I don't. I'm just making all that up. Police groups around the state say an official legal opinion on police reforms backs up what they have been stressing all along. It is vital to public safety for lawmakers to provide some clarity on the intent of the state's reform laws. So let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Yes, I'll get into more detail about what the AG's opinion on these laws said, but the gist is this, that it's uncertain. There's so much uncertainty in the law that the AG, in his opinion, couldn't even give a definitive guidance, if you will.
Yikes.
And he strongly suggested that the lawmakers get back in there and fix these so that there's some clarity. Because as it stands now, the cops are right, basically. They can't go on these mental health calls. They can't do a lot of the things that they say that they can't because there's just not enough clarity in the laws. So there's been a lot of work going on this session already to address some of the issues. Roger Goodman has been one of the leads on this, Democratic chair of the House Public Safety Committee, and he's been talking to law enforcement all over the state.
I met with dozens of chiefs and sheriffs and mental health professionals and other first responders and city and county leaders. And the common theme that we have heard is that police, when they are stopping someone, just detaining them as a suspect, that the person can just walk away, that the police have no authority to put hands on to prevent someone simply from walking away or running away from a detention. And that concerns me.
So to address that, he has been, he's out with a bill in the middle of, or 2 weeks into session.
I've introduced House Bill 2037 to allow police to use force to prevent someone from fleeing in an investigatory detention. Force sounds violent. We're not talking about hurting someone, just preventing their movement, restraining them. I do believe that a police need the authority to prevent someone from fleeing a detention. It's not probable cause at that point. It's only reasonable suspicion. But this proactive policing and the ability for police to investigate and question suspects is an important part of their work.
And he says, as far as the AG opinion goes, it confirms what they were feeling already.
That police cannot use force to prevent someone from fleeing a detention. In addition, the Attorney General, in its opinion, said that police cannot use obstruction as a way to prevent someone from fleeing. In other words, you try to detain them and they walk away and then you arrest them for obstruction. That doesn't work. Obstruction has to be more than that, not just walking away. And that's what the Attorney General opinion outlined. So I'm also very concerned about the use of obstruction in a racially disproportionate manner, which has been what the history has shown.
And he says all these issues are critical. And at the bottom line for him, as far as that particular issue goes,
we really do need to give the police the tool to engage in investigatory work, to detain suspects briefly, not to use force during that detention, because that is severely restricted by law and by case law, but to prevent them from fleeing. And there's like word on the street that people can just walk away if a police tries to stop them. And we really want to close that gap and allow police to do their work.
And that's that word on the street he's talking about. I've heard multiple law enforcement officers who've been testifying so far this session on the need for these fixes that there are. There's criminals who just go, hey, I don't have to stay and talk to you. I can just leave. So that's part of the problem that they're seeing out on the street because of this. Now, so obviously, basically what the AG opinion said there about the investigatory detention and the use of force is there's that need for clarity. Roger Goodman is working on that. And there seems to be some consensus there. But that's not the only area of concern.
One other common theme that we heard when talking to police chiefs and sheriffs was that force is not defined. And so what does force mean? And the Attorney General, we asked the Attorney General for this, for an official opinion, and they issued that as well. And so I have put into the bill I introduced, House Bill 2037, a definition of force. It might not be the right definition, and we'll talk about what it ends up being, but it's very important to have a concrete definition of force so that police know what they can do and what they can't do, what force is and what force isn't, so that they can do their work and comply with the law.
So as it stands, his bill that he just dropped with that definition of physical force is defined like this.
The definition of force that I came up with for my bill, just the original draft, comes from a consensus document from 11 national and international law enforcement organizations that talks about the use of a physical restraint to overcome resistance. And, you know, there's circumstances where police will use force and they're not trying to overcome resistance. And so it actually should be broader than that. And also I have some concern about an officer, let's say there's no video recording, you know, the officer could say, well, he was resisting. And so use force and that might have been inappropriate. So I think we're going to come up with a definition of force that everybody's comfortable with, but we have to have a definition. We have to have that certainty so that police know what force is and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do.
So, again, that's going to be something that continues to get worked on. The other issue that isn't in the AG opinion but is a huge concern, and there's a lot of disagreement still, is vehicular pursuits. So that's something that I expect to maybe get worked out this session, maybe not. It's a big question for police.
So the legislature, in its zeal to figure out a way to prevent police officers from arresting or just beating up people based on skin color, it has essentially made it impossible to arrest anybody.
In those specific situations. So we're talking about the Terry stops, which is investigatory mm-hmm. detention, and then the mental health holds, and it has to do with that physical force, the lack of a definition. And
So that means, so if you witness somebody running out of Nordstrom's with a bunch of stolen clothes, you can still forcibly detain that person. Is that right?
As long as you have reasonable, you have a probable cause that a crime has been committed, right? So yes.
Okay. So what we're talking about now is cops just walking down the street and deciding to interview somebody, basically.
Proactive policing.
Proactive policing. Yeah, exactly.
But it's a necessary tool. And then again, with that mental health situation, when you can put your hands on someone, it's just, I know what the intent of the lawmakers was, and mm-hmm. it was not to, you know, keep that from happening. The problem is the language in their original bills does not specify, and there was so much uncertainty that I was surprised by this legal opinion. I really was from the AG you got to fix it.
Was the language that was passed last session?
Yes, this is of all the police bills that were passed last session. So, and I do want to make sure that I'm clear on something. These are some very fine-tuning kind of things. They're big deals, right? Big implications. But Roger Goodman says the important thing is, because some of the family members who pushed for reforms are like, this is rolling everything back. That's not what's happening. There are still really significant accountability measures in place based on the bills that were passed last year. Decertification, various other things, background checks on new cops, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
For bad actors, all kinds of things.
One of the big problems was the fact that you would have clear video showing cops just way overreacting, but there would never be a penalty. That part's been fixed, right?
Right. There's the accountability measures, right? So you decertify and you lie or whatever it is you do, and you're not allowed to be a cop in this state anymore. There's lots of that. So that's all still in place. It's the fine tuning of the language and these couple of things that needs to be fixed so that cops can do their jobs.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.